or the tintinnabulation of a jingly necklace. To remember tintinnabulation in your vocabulary notebook, highlight the T-I-N and connect it to the related word tinnitus. What's tinnitus? It's that ringing sensation in your ears that you just can't get rid of. Okay, let's move from bells to something a bit more quiet, like a whisper. Let's move to shh. Are you listening? Susurration. Susurration is a noun referring to an indistinct whispering or rustling sound, a murmur. If you're within a mile or so of a beach, you might just be able to hear the susurration of the waves breaking. Shh. Shh. In fact, a lot of folks like the susurration of a wave machine to help put them to sleep. Or you might hear the susurration of the wind gently rustling the leaves in a forest. Or think about the background chatter in those movie scenes where two people are talking at dinner. Now, when I was a kid, my mom told us that if the extras in the background didn't know what to say to create the sound of a muffled conversation, the director would tell them to say, "Rhubarbs and berries, rhubarbs and berries," over and over again in a whisper. Now, I never found out if this was true or not, but I do remember my siblings and I walking around one day whispering, "Rhubarbs and berries, rhubarbs and berries," trying to get the susurration of background chatter just right. So to remember susurration, write the shh next to the word in your vocabulary notebook. For our final target sound word, I've got a question for you. Have you ever been in a meeting with a pompous speaker who loves to clear their throat in an audibly self-important manner, especially to show that they disapprove of what was just said? I mean, imagine this. One person in the meeting makes a statement that obviously does not sit well with the bloviating blowhard in the room. And so, this know-it-all responds like this. I certainly, for one, do not agree with that remark. Well, English has an excellent word and one of my favorites for this sound. Harumph. Say it with me. Harumph. Harumph. Can't you just picture this supercilious peacock clearing his throat, standing up out of his chair, straightening his jacket, puffing up his chest, and getting ready to expound and hold forth? Harumph is a verb meaning to make a pretentious show of clearing one's throat. When answering a question that rankled him, the self-important professor always harumphed a bit before responding to the class in his usual didactic manner. Now, harumph also carries a second sense to offer brief critical comments, as in, when presented with our new plan, the curmudgeonly CEO quibbled and harumphed, as he always did, and then let us have our way. Now, to remember harumph, connect it to an arrogant, pompous know-it-all. If they literally clear their throats a lot, then you've got a great personal connection. And if they don't, write down that this person probably would harumph if they'd taken this course. Now, the last target word we'll pull from our grab bag is trenchant. And for this word, I think of my Uncle Jim. An attorney by trade, Uncle Jim was a fantastic person with an incredibly dry sense of humor. He had a lively and penetrating mind and a razor-sharp wit. He read at least 2 newspapers front to back daily and seemed to know everything and be able to comment intelligently on everything. During a conversation, his insights would cut right to the heart of the matter. Now, he was always a gentleman, but he did not suffer fools gladly. And you didn't want to get into an argument with him unless you knew your stuff. He would marshal all the facts at his disposal and deliver his verbal thrusts, skewering his opponent with hard-hitting points that could be both cutting and disarming. So my Uncle Jim's insightful analysis and arguments were trenchant. Trenchant is an adjective meaning forceful and clear, penetrating, keen, and incisive. You'll often see trenchant used to describe people and language, like a trenchant argument, a trenchant analysis, or trenchant criticism. Trenchant can also imply caustic and cutting. So here's an example of trenchant in context. The professor's trenchant comments were hard-hitting and right on the mark. Now, trenchant comes from the old French word spelled the same way, which meant cutting and sharp, both literally and figuratively. So let's use the related word strategy. When you look at trenchant, do any words or word parts jump out at you? If you said trench, you're right. Trenchant is related to the word trench. Now, when I say trench, you probably think of the trenches of World War I, or trench coats, which were first worn by British officers in the trenches. Now, here's the helpful part. Originally, a trench meant a track cut in wood, and was later extended to mean a cut in the earth, what we think of as a trench. So to remember trenchant, highlight the word trench in your vocabulary notebook, and make the connection that a trench is a cut in the earth, or a long, narrow ditch. Write the word cut, and write down that trenchant remarks are cutting, sharp, and incisive. Also, make a personal connection to trenchant. We all know someone like my Uncle Jim, someone who is sharp-witted, who can make an effective, insightful, and powerful argument. Write this person's name down next to trenchant, and be careful of getting into an argument with this trenchant debater. Okay, now that we've learned a few new target words, let's do what we did in our last grab bag lecture. Let's review some target words that we introduced in previous lectures. Now remember, I want to use these grab bag lectures in part to emphasize and model the importance of reviewing the words in your vocabulary notebook. Consistent review and practice will keep your vocabulary chops in tip-top shape. Okay, our first set of review words all relate to language. Shibboleth, argo, and jargon. Now listen carefully, because I'm going to give one scenario that challenges your knowledge of all three words. Here's the scenario. There's a secret society on your college campus called the Cranium and the Clavicle. It's so secret that the names of the Cranium and Clavicle members are only made public upon their death. And rumor has it that the society has its own specialized language that includes a lot of vocabulary words and phrases that only have meaning to members, called crannies. And it's also said that society members have a phrase they use with each other as a sort of verbal test to distinguish society members from non-members. So, what might you call the specialized language of the crannies? Would it be better termed argo or jargon? Answer? Well, that depends on your purpose and your point of view. If you want to emphasize the specialized nature of their lingo, you would refer to it as society argo, the specialized language of a particular group. However, if you're a non-society member and want to emphasize the fact that you can't understand these people, you refer to it as jargon. And what would you call the test phrase society members use to identify a fellow cranny? Answer, shibboleth. Shibboleth is a noun referring to a word, phrase, or custom used to distinguish one group from another group. Okay, let's move on from words for language to words that denote three different types of people. Quislings, Luddites, and Philistines. Situation one. You work with someone who won't answer her email, has never been on Facebook, and refuses to own a cell phone. In fact, she still has the old school rotary phone in her office, and she loves taking the time to dial numbers with a lot of eights and nines. What would you call this person? A Philistine or a Luddite? Answer? She's definitely a Luddite. A Luddite is someone who opposes the introduction of technological change. Situation two. Your next door neighbor is a barbarian. He throws loud, obnoxious parties every weekend and sleeps most of the day, only venturing forth for fast food. He also proudly claims to have never read a book through the entire way in his entire life. Is your neighbor a Philistine or a Quisling? Answer, He's definitely a Philistine. Philistines are not interested in intellectual pursuits and are indifferent or hostile to artistic and cultural values. Now, if this Philistine had also betrayed his country and aided an invading force with the hopes of serving in their puppet government, then he'd be a quisling to boot. Okay, our next set of three adjectives could be used to describe people or their actions. Draconian, quixotic, and avuncular. See if you can figure out who is what in our next vignette. So here's the scenario. You're 18 and you're desperately head over heels in love. However, your girlfriend's father is the most severely harsh disciplinarian you've ever met. Once, he grounded your girlfriend for a month for not going to bed by 9 p.m. However, you've got a secret weapon, your wealthy aunt. She's always been kind and indulgent with you. And knowing that you're in love, she's offered to let you borrow her ladder, a Porsche 911, and her credit card. And your plan is to elope, keep on driving west until you find your very own Shangri-La and start your own life together. So with that scenario in mind, I've got three people for you to identify. The harsh disciplinarian of a father, your kind, indulgent, and very wealthy aunt, and you and your girlfriend. So which of you is best described as quixotic? Which is avuncular? And which is draconian? Well, the father's exceedingly harsh and severe, so he's definitely draconian. Remember, Draco, the severe Athenian legislator and his harsh laws? Now, avuncular means like an uncle, but it can also mean kind, friendly, patient, and indulgent, particularly with folks who are younger. So your aunt is actually avuncular. And your dreams to elope and find Shangri-La? Well, some might characterize them as quixotic, romantically idealistic. Okay, our last set of review words, two adjectives and one verb, could be linked to types of speaking. Turgid, discursive, and importune. Now, for this scenario, I want you to imagine that you're the captain of your college debate team. And you've got two new students who want to try out for the team this year. But each of them has their own issue. The first student never seems to be able to stay on topic while making his arguments. He rambles on and on, goes off on tangents, and constantly jumps from subject to subject. The second student has a different problem. While she is focused and makes insightful comments, she's given to highfalutin, pompous language, and comes across sounding arrogant and condescending. Unfortunately, as captain, it's your job to tell both students that they didn't make the team this year. But both students start asking, demanding, and insisting that you put them on the team. They won't take no for an answer. I mean, every time you see them on campus, they continue nagging and pestering you to change your mind. They just won't stop. So, my first question, which word would you use to describe the student harassing you with repeated requests to put them on the team? Turgid, discursive, or importune? Answer? Importune. When someone importunes you, they incessantly ask and demand. Okay, so we're left with turgid and discursive. Which word best describes the speaking style of the first student who rambles on and on? And which word best describes the ostentatious, over-the-top language used by that second student? Well, the student who jumps from subject to subject is a discursive debater. And the second student uses turgid language, meaning swollen or overly ornamented speech. All right, so far today, we've reached into our grab bag and come up with a few new items. And we've taken a little time to review some words from lectures past. Now, I'd like to close with a vocabulary learning tip that you can put in your toolkit as a lifelong connoisseur of words. So take a step back and notice what we just did with our situation review activities. We did something that you can do as an excellent way to consolidate your understanding of new vocabulary. We compared and contrasted and connected the words in sets of two or three. Comparing and contrasting concepts, including vocabulary words, is one of the absolute best learning activities that I know of. A 2003 study of college students in the field of management sheds light on the power of comparing and contrasting as a learning tool. Researchers asked the management students to analyze a set of negotiation training scenarios. The first group analyzed the cases one by one. The researchers asked the second group to compare the cases. So which group do you think learned more? Well, not surprisingly, the researchers found that the group that compared the cases learned significantly more. Now, why do you think this is? Well, it's because when we compare concepts, ideas, or words, we're forced to identify the deep features that make two things similar or different. And that type of deep thinking leads to deep, long-term, meaningful learning. I mean, think about it. If you really want to know what the blues is, it helps to compare and contrast it with jazz, right? And you can't really appreciate the importance of Athens in ancient Greek history without comparing and contrasting it with Sparta. And comparing and contrasting works well with vocabulary words, too. For example, in our last situation review, with our target words turgid and discursive, you were forced to think about those words, both adjectives which could describe language, by comparing the different types of language used by two students. So before our next lecture, I want you to try out this compare, contrast, connect vocabulary strategy. Okay, so take these three steps. First, go back through your vocabulary notebook and pick three words that you find are connected in some way. Now, they don't have to be connected closely as long as you see a connection. Perhaps the words can all describe different types of people, like our example of draconian, avuncular, and quixotic. You can certainly pick words from the same lecture, as I've already grouped many words by theme. However, you could just as easily identify your own set of three words from across different lectures. Sometimes that's a lot more fun. Second, try and cook up a situation, just like I did, in which you can apply all three words, and write that situation down. Vocabulary experts Isabel Beck, Margaret G. McCown, and Linda Kukin have demonstrated the power of placing words in rich contexts and situations. Maybe the situation involves people you already know, or circumstances you've been in. But visualize these people or circumstances alongside the three words that you've chosen. Now, the third step is the important part. Compare and contrast the words by comparing and contrasting the people or the circumstances. If you'd like a pattern for this assignment, just go back to my scenario involving the avuncular ant. Three vocabulary words and just one scenario that enables you to connect and compare all three. And with that as your model, see if you can devise a vignette or two or three vignettes of your own. Just remember, comparing, contrasting, and connecting words is a great way to dig deeper into word meanings.
Lecture 33, Building Vocabulary Through Games.
Now that we're nearing the end of our course, I'd like to do something a little different today. I want to share some ideas that will help you not only maintain, but continue to improve your vocabulary knowledge after this course is over. We'll start our lecture with some vocabulary games and activities that are not only fun to play, but will keep your vocabulary in shape. And then we'll discuss how you can leverage the power of context to improve your reading and writing vocabulary. So, why vocabulary games? Well, we want vocabulary knowledge that's broad, deep, and flexible. Broad vocabulary knowledge means we know a lot of words and can make connections among these words. Deep vocabulary knowledge means the words that we do know, we know well. For example, this deep knowledge includes knowing when to use Donnybrook and when to use imbroglio to describe two different types of disagreements. And flexible vocabulary knowledge means we can apply our words to new situations when we speak and write. This flexible knowledge also helps us infer word meanings from context. Now, vocabulary games get at all three: vocabulary breadth, depth, and flexibility. However, I think vocabulary play is particularly helpful with flexibility, as games provide opportunities and challenges for us to use and think about words in novel and creative ways. So, let's get started with some vocabulary games. Now, most are games you can play with someone else: friends, classmates, family members. And our first game is called Hink Pinks. Hink Pinks are word riddles. The answer is always a two-word pair that rhymes. Let's look at a few examples. So first, I'll state the riddle. And then for each riddle, I'll give you a syllable clue to help you with the answer. If the rhyming pair consists of two one-syllable words, I'll say Hink Pink. If the rhyming pair consists of two two-syllable words, I'll say Hinky Pinky. And if the rhyming pair consists of two three-syllable words, I'll say Hinkity Pinkity. All right, let's try one out. Ready? What's a rhyming pair for a mournful father? Hink Pink. So, you need to think of a synonym for mournful, a synonym for father, and make sure these two synonyms rhyme with each other. And because the syllable clue is Hink Pink, you know that the two words in the answer are both one-syllable words. Okay? So, can you think of a two-word rhyming pair, both one-syllable words, for a mournful father? Well, one answer is a sad dad. All right, let's try another. What do you call an ecstatic patriarch? Hinky Pinky. Okay, so we want a rhyming pair of synonyms for an ecstatic patriarch. And because it's Hinky Pinky, both words are two syllables. Answer? A happy pappy. Now, vocabulary researchers Camille Blackowitz and Peter Fisher offer this excellent riddle. What's an evil preacher? Hinkity Pinkity. Okay, Hinkity Pinkity tells us we need a pair of three-syllable words that rhyme. So what's an evil preacher? Answer, a sinister minister. All right. And here's one more. What do you call a short-tempered flower child from the 1960s? Hinky Pinky. All right, so think of another word for a flower child and another word for short-tempered: a snippy hippie. All right, now that we've got the hang of it, let's use some of our target vocabulary words from previous lectures in our riddles. So what do you call a pusillanimous blackbird? Hinky Pinky. All right, so think of another word for blackbird, another word for pusillanimous: craven raven. All right, here's another one. What do you call a fractious young person? Hink Pink. A fractious young person. So another word for a young person and another word for fractious. Answer, a wild child. All right, next one. What do you call a more erudite pugilist? Hinky Pinky. A more erudite pugilist. So another word for pugilist, and one that rhymes that stands for more erudite. Answer, a brighter fighter. Okay, what do you call an indolent flower? Hinky Pinky. An indolent flower. Answer, a lazy daisy. And finally, this is a hard one, what do you call a callow legume? Hink Pink. A callow legume. Answer, a green bean. Okay, so after you finish today's lecture, I want you to create your own Hink Pinks. And to help you out, here's an easy three-step process from a book I co-authored, Vocabulary Their Way. So first, create a word pair that rhymes, like sad, dead. And often it works to pair an adjective with a noun. Second, think of more sophisticated synonyms for both of these answer words. So for sad, you might think, mournful, wistful. And for dad, might be patriarch. And if you want, this is the time to go to the thesaurus. These synonyms make up your riddle. And third, pose the riddle as a question with your syllable clue. In this case, hink pink. And put all three steps together and you get, what do you call a mournful patriarch? Hink pink. Answer, a sad dad. Now, once you practice the three-step process a bit, I want you to go to the next level. And that involves using the hink pink game to review the target vocabulary words you've learned in this course. Now to do that, it's usually easier to start with the target words as your riddle, not your answer. Okay, for example, when I was looking at my vocabulary notebook, I saw our target word indolent. So immediately I thought of several synonyms and related words like lackadaisical and lazy. And then I just started thinking of nouns that rhymed with some of these synonyms. Lackadaisical. Macadaisical. Nope, I couldn't think of any rhyme words for that one. But lazy, lazy daisy, that's my answer. Then I went back and made my riddle using the target word indolent. What do you call an indolent flower? Once you get the hang of hink pinks, you can play them anywhere, anytime. You don't need a special game board or equipment. One person creates the clues and the other the answers, and then you switch. Hink pinks are not only a lot of fun, they can really boost your vocabulary knowledge and flexibility. Now, another engaging game to play is one my colleagues and I call Clue Review. And there's also a commercially published game that's similar called Headbands. Clue Review is an engaging way to review a lot of vocabulary quickly with someone else. To play Clue Review, first write your target vocabulary words on index cards. Packs of 20 to 30 or so are usually a good number. Two players divide the roles. One person is the clue giver, and the second person is in the hot seat. And if you're on the hot seat, shuffle the deck of vocabulary cards face down. Randomly take one card from the deck and place it on your forehead so that your partner, the clue giver, can see the word, but you cannot. Yeah, it looks a bit silly with a card on your forehead, but that's part of the fun. Now, the clues can be either a definition or an example of the word. For example, for the word Gemütlichkeit, the clue giver might say to me, a German loanword referring to a feeling of coziness and comfort. Or the clue giver might give an example and say, I think of Thanksgiving for this word. If the person in the hot seat, me, gets the right word, he or she puts the card down and pulls the next card in the deck. Or like my students, you just zip the card across the room. If the person in the hot seat can't guess the word, he or she just says pass. And if the clue giver can't figure out a clue, he or she also says pass. And the goal is for the pair to correctly identify all the cards from the deck without either person saying pass. Or for a challenge, you can time yourself to see how quickly you can go through the entire deck. And when you're done, switch roles with your partner. If you have four people, you can divide into two teams of two, each playing each other. Time each team to see who has the fastest time getting through the entire deck. Now, I've played this game with students of all ages for many years and have learned that, as classroom management guru Fred Jones says, all students have a PhD in teacher management. So, my students figured out ways around learning the words. For example, one time I had two middle school students playing this game. We were in the middle of our unit on the Civil War, and the target word was antebellum. But instead of giving a clue like, this word means before the war, this student's clue for antebellum was, get this, sounds like schmanty schmellum. Answer, antebellum. Next word. So I learned quickly that you cannot do a sounds like clue for this game. And you might want to make a rule that the clue has to have something to do with the word's meaning. And with this approach, definitions, related words, and personal connections to the word would all be fair play. Now, if you don't like putting the card on your head, simply give the deck to the clue giver, who pulls the cards and gives the clues to the person on the hot seat. Although, this is a lot less fun. Now, Let's turn to perhaps my favorite commercially published vocabulary game of all time, Taboo. Taboo is a wonderful game for developing your vocabulary flexibility, using words in new and creative ways. In Taboo, our family usually plays in two teams of two. Now, it's similar to Clue Review in that one person gives their partner the clues to a target word printed on a card, but there's a huge catch. If you're giving the clue for a target word to your partner, there are a number of taboo words that you're not allowed to use as your clue words. And here's the kicker. These taboo words are the very words you are most likely to think of as clues for your target word. And to keep the clue giver honest, a member of the other team is next to him or her with a handheld buzzer and buzzes him if he accidentally says one of the taboo words. For example, let's say you're the clue giver with a pack of taboo cards in front of you, and your partner is sitting across from you. And let's say you pull out a card with the target name John F. Kennedy. Now, what clues might you want to give your partner if you had John F. Kennedy? Well, your first clue might be something like 1960s president. Well, if you said president, you'd be buzzed, because this would probably be one of the taboo words, as would assassination, Bay of Pigs, Jacqueline Kennedy, and Grassy Knoll. Now, my dad and I sometimes play as a team against my wife and mother-in-law, and they nearly always kill us, and here's why. Now, my dad's a pretty logical thinker, and he immediately thinks of the most likely clues, which are invariably the taboo words, unless he's always getting buzzed, which is not a pretty sight, because my dad can also be pretty handy with the salty language. It's constant buzzing and Billingsgate when my dad and I are playing. However, my wife and mother-in-law are pretty flexible thinkers and are good at connecting over shared experiences. So as I remember it, they actually had this John F. Kennedy card. And here's how they got around the taboo words. Mom, do you remember when we went shopping today? Yes. What did we see that we loved? Oh yeah, that bag. And who did you say you thought it belonged to? Jackie Kennedy. And she was married to who? John F. Kennedy. Next word. I mean, they're incredible at this game. I wish Taboo was a game show because they'd win millions. But the point I want to make is that this game can do a lot for your vocabulary. Taboo gets you to think flexibly about words, make personal connections to words, the Jackie Kennedy bag, and use synonyms or antonyms for taboo words. So even if taboo doesn't lend itself specifically to reviewing our target words, it has a lot in common with some of our strategies as lifelong vocabulary learners. Thinking flexibly, making connections, using synonyms and antonyms and related words, all fantastic ways to improve your vocabulary while you're having a ton of fun. Now, there are a host of other wonderful games that you can play while incorporating our target vocabulary. Take the classic parlor game Charades, where you might select a few target words and act them out. And how about creating your own crossword puzzle using words from your vocabulary notebook? And there's a number of commercially published games that really tap your vocabulary and spelling knowledge, like Scrabble and Words with Friends. I could go on and still not cover them all. But here's my main point. Vocabulary games are not only fun, but they can be effective vocabulary builders. So try one out. So, games can be one fun and effective way to continue improving your vocabulary knowledge after you finish this course. What's another way? Perhaps the most powerful way. Context. Now remember, we pick up most of our new vocabulary knowledge incidentally from reading in context. So, reading a lot for meaning is one of the best things you can do to improve your vocabulary knowledge. So let's discuss how you can leverage context to get the most out of it. Let's say you're reading a book and encounter the following sentence. Miles disliked his job primarily because of his bumptious boss. Now, if you didn't already know the meaning of bumptious, this context wouldn't be too supportive, would it? I mean, from this sentence, you do get the idea that bumptious is a negative thing. But there are a lot of negative things Miles' boss could be, including conniving, wishy-washy, and draconian. This sentence does not give us enough context to infer the specific meaning of bumptious, now does it? And in fact, this is exactly what we find from the research. A single contextual encounter with an unfamiliar word is not always sufficient in helping readers infer its exact meaning. And you might be thinking, wait a minute, Kevin. You just said that we pick up most of our new vocabulary from reading in context. But then you also argued that context is not always adequate for picking up word meanings. So how can both these statements be true? Well, the answer is that we learn words incrementally. Remember the dimmer switch phenomenon we discussed in our first lecture? You may not be able to infer the meaning of bumptious after your first encounter, but each time you encounter bumptious in a new context, the meaning of bumptious gradually grows brighter in your mental lexicon. So, can we speed up this incremental process by which we encounter and learn words from context? Yes, we can. And here's how. Let's say you come upon an unfamiliar word while reading. What do? Well, you could just stop reading and look up the word's meaning in a dictionary. However, most of us are not reading primarily to learn new words, are we? Instead, I mean, we read a novel for pleasure or a how-to manual for information. So most of the time, I don't stop reading to look up an unfamiliar word, especially if the word isn't absolutely necessary to my overall understanding of the text. I mean, so what should you do? Well, first, you can try and infer the meaning of the word from the contextual information that surrounds it. And you can put that together with clues within the word, like Latin and Greek affixes and roots, the word's morphology. Whenever you encounter an unfamiliar word, use context and morphology together to infer word meanings. In fact, our bumptious sentence is a great example of this. Miles disliked his job, primarily because of his bumptious boss. Okay, we know from the surrounding context that bumptious is a negative thing. That's a start. However, we can learn even more if we analyze bumptious by its morphology. So, look at the word's internal structure. What word parts do you see in bumptious? Bump, which if you remember is the source for the word bumptious. A negative boss who bumps people is pushy. And that is, in fact, the basic meaning of this word. So you see how context and morphology can work together? So when you encounter an unfamiliar word while reading, do what literacy experts Doug Fisher and Nancy Frey say. Look inside the word and outside the word for clues. Okay, now, even if you can use morphology and context to get a rough idea of a word's meaning, I recommend that you take further steps to make it stick in your mental lexicon. So here's what you should also do when you encounter unfamiliar words while reading. First, just mark the word for later reference. Either highlight it or underline it if you own the book, or write it on a sticky note like I do, or record it on your cell phone or tablet. This way, you won't lose the flow of your reading and you can examine it later. Then, set aside some time to look up the words marked. Look up the definition in the dictionary. Look at all the meanings of the word and see which meaning best fits the context. And bring your vocabulary notebook into play. Write down all the important information about the word in your vocabulary notebook, just as we've been doing throughout this course, including its part of speech and morphology. The word may fit into one of the categories that we've already created in our vocabulary notebook, like War and Peace. Or you might start your own category if the word doesn't fit neatly anywhere else. Now, you might not do this for all the words you mark while reading, but if you just do a few words a week, you'll be surprised at how quickly your vocabulary notebook will grow. And here's one step a lot of folks don't do, and it will only take you a few minutes more, but it is the best way I know to improve your chances of really getting a sense of the word and being able to use it yourself. Find a dictionary that has a lot of usage examples. Webster's Third New International Dictionary is known for having a number of excellent actual usage examples of the words. Or find an online dictionary and read 5 to 10 usage examples. Vocabulary.com is a free online dictionary that has many, many wonderful usage examples drawn from sources like the New York Times and Newsweek. it'll take you just a few minutes more to read about 5 to 10 usage examples. But those few minutes may save you 6 months to a year or more. How? Because instead of waiting for the next time you happen to encounter Bumptious, you've stacked the deck in your favor by making sure you encounter it 5 to 10 times in rich context right there. Trading in 6 months to a year for a few extra minutes. How's that for a great time saver? And here's another tip. While reading these usage examples, note any words that are usually used with the word. The collocates. If you want to really know how to use fulminate, it's helpful to know that one of its collocates is against, as in the preacher fulminated against gambling. Okay, in sum, one of the most powerful ways to pick up new vocabulary is to read a lot. But remember that just one encounter with an unfamiliar word may not be enough. So, when you encounter an unfamiliar word, what can you do to stack the deck in your favor? Okay, let's review 4 steps. First, see if the context outside the word and any morphological clues inside the word help you figure out its meaning. Second, mark the word in some way and look it up later. Third, when you do look up the word, record it in your vocabulary notebook using all the strategies we've discussed in this course, making personal connections, jotting down morphological and etymological notes, and so on. And fourth and finally, take a few minutes more and read 5 to 10 usage examples. All right, that's one way to leverage the power of context. Context can help boost your vocabulary knowledge. But this discussion of context brings up another critical aspect of vocabulary knowledge, knowing how to effectively use words, even relatively simple words in context, to communicate what you want. And I know of no better way to get a feel for how to use words in context than to examine great writing. So I want you to listen to the following memorable quotations and see if you can guess where and or who these lines are from. We few, we happy few, we band of brothers. For he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother. From the St. Crispin's Day speech of Shakespeare's Henry V. Okay, our next quote. You cannot shake hands with a clenched fist. From the great Indian Prime Minister Indira Gandhi. And one of the great opening lines in all of American literature. In our family, there was no clear line between religion and fly fishing. From A River Runs Through It by Norman MacLean. Wisdom, beauty, humor. It's all there in these finely crafted lines. Now, some might argue that reading these great lines won't improve your vocabulary because we already know all the words already. But I would argue that knowing how to craft a beautiful sentence with a precise word, even a relatively simple word, is perhaps the ultimate goal of building a better vocabulary. So in your vocabulary notebook, I strongly recommend creating a section called the Golden Line. As you come across a turn of phrase that stuns you with its beauty, or that cuts right through you, or that makes you want to spit out your coffee because you're laughing so hard, mark it and write it down. And here's old school for you. Try and actually memorize it. I think one of the things we've lost today in education is memorizing some of the great lines from poetry, speeches, and books. Now, it's not that I believe we should memorize something just to be able to spit it out to the teacher. Rather, as we memorize something like a poem, we should also delve into its meaning. Memory and meaning go hand in hand. When we search the meaning of a speech, it makes the memorizing meaningful. And I think there's something else. When we memorize something, we develop a feel for the music and rhythm of language. This sense of written language begins to seep into your bones. Now, I'm not talking about proper grammar here. You can have a deadly boring sentence that's grammatically correct. I'm talking about that elusive sense for how words combine to convey feeling and meaning. So collect these golden lines and use them to deepen your appreciation of the way words really work. Okay, so the golden line is another great strategy for your vocabulary toolbox, a way to get a feel for how great writers put words in action. But what if you want to move from reading great lines to writing great lines? Well, this isn't a course on writing, but there is an effective tool to increase your use of targeted vocabulary words and phrases in your own writing. Vocabulary banks. So what's a vocabulary bank? It's simply a bank of high utility words and phrases that you create and keep handy while writing to remind you of possible word choices. For example, I teach graduate students who want to become reading specialists. And as part of their job, they need to learn how to write a case report. However, I soon learned that most students are not used to writing in this reportees, the language of reports. So, I created a sample case report and a bank of stock words and phrases that they can draw from, such as, taken together, these literacy assessments indicate, or self-monitoring his or her reading, or self-correcting meaning change errors. And my students' writing quickly improved. And they weren't just copying words and phrases from our vocabulary bank. Often they'd start with them, but then they'd tweak them to make them fit their report. So I want you to think about how vocabulary banks might work in your job or with your own writing. For example, if you do a fair amount of informational writing in your job, you might want to create a vocabulary bank of summarizing words so you're not always going to your favorite in conclusion. Check out a thesaurus for synonyms for your vocabulary bank. Now, the following are examples based on the work of vocabulary researchers Jeff Swires and Diana Townsend. These are other words you might use other than in conclusion. Consequently, taken as a whole, in other words, in short, in summary, in simpler terms, on the whole, therefore. Or, you might have a bank of words that signal cause-effect relationships, like thus, therefore, as a result, this led to, this gave rise to, in turn, for this reason, it follows, consequently, and the ramifications of. Okay, now, we're probably familiar with all these phrases, but how many of us can keep them all in our mind to draw on when we need them? So, a vocabulary bank serves as a repository of important words for you to keep as a handy reference. They're a way to keep powerful possible word choices front and center while you're writing. So, add vocabulary bank sections in your vocabulary notebook, like conclusion words or company buzzwords. Then, while writing at work, keep your vocabulary notebook handy as a quick reference. Vocabulary banks can add precision and variety to your writing. So what's the main takeaway from today's lecture? Well, let me leave you with this thought. After this course is over, don't let your vocabulary learning revert to a deadly process of drilling words from a long, dry list. Leverage the power of context by consistently applying the strategies that we learned today. And make learning fun by trying out some vocabulary games. In short, spice it up.
Lecture 34, Words English Borrowed and Never Returned.
Picture yourself going for a stroll outside on a cold, brisk, late November day. As you breathe out, your breath turns into a little cloud in the air. I've got a question for you. What do you call that little cloud that hangs there for just a second? What's the word for it? We say things like, I could see my breath this morning, but does English have a single word for breath that condenses in the air? Incredibly, I've asked around and looked around, and I haven't found a single word that's passed into common usage for this phenomenon that we all produce on cold mornings. As amazing as it is to believe, English, a language which seems to have words for just about anything and everything, still has some gaps or language lacunae. So, what can we do when we have a concept like condensed breath that we don't have a label for? How could we fill in this gap? Well, if you think it's a concept important enough to find a word for, we have a couple of options. First, we could create our own word for it, start using it, and see if it catches on. For example, we might go the portmanteau route, taking parts of words we already know that relate to the concept and joining them together. Remember how smoke and fog generated smog? I asked a colleague at work about this condensed breath gap in English, and she came up with what I think is a fantastic portmanteau word, frostboration. What do you think? We might define frostboration as something like this: a noun that refers to the act of exhaling water vapor that condenses into a small, foggy cloud when it's cold. The etymology for frostboration might be something like this: the word frostboration originated in 2014 as a combination of frost plus respiration. The word frostboration spread rapidly and was used widely by 2020, becoming a common term used by weather forecasters and early morning joggers in the fall and winter. It is now commonly cited in linguistics classes as an example of how quickly new words can spread. So, if you think frostboration is a good word, start using it with your family, friends, and folks you work with. Maybe just casually slip it into a conversation and see what happens. So the next cold morning you arrive at school or work, say something like this: "Man, it was cold this morning. I was even frostbrating inside my car until the heat started cranking up." Just act like it's a real word and see what happens. Now, you might get some looks, or you might get a friend who starts using it. Who knows? If we all start using frostboration, maybe we'll have it in Webster's in a few years. However, if we didn't want to go to the trouble of creating a word, we could go a completely different route to fill in this language gap. We could see if another language already had a word for that concept and simply borrow it. We wouldn't even have to ask to borrow the word. We could just take it, keep it, and if we really liked it, never return it. That might be simpler. At first, we would probably only use this borrowed word with other English speakers who already were familiar with the source language, the original language that we borrowed the word from. However, if the word started catching on and enough speakers started using the word, it would become a loan word. And that's what this lecture is about: words English borrowed from other languages and never returned. In particular, this language is the first in a 2-lecture sequence on words and phrases that are collectively called lexical borrowings by linguists. We'll be looking at words that are obviously from another language, like faux pas, an embarrassing social blunder, from French. And we'll be looking at words that have become so common in English, you might not be aware that they were ever borrowed, like grenade, also from French. Now, unlike some languages like French, English is very democratic in the sense that it's always been open to new words from anywhere and everywhere. In fact, substantially more than half of English vocabulary is from languages other than its Anglo-Saxon ancestor, Old English. Now, before we begin with our target words for today, I want to give you a sense of the breadth and diversity of the words English has borrowed from other languages. So, listen to this list of different languages and the loanwords English adopted from them, either completely or with some modification. Let's start with Italian. From Italian, we get musical words like a cappella, maestro, opera, and virtuoso. Artistic words including fresco, graffiti, stucco, and terracotta. And of course, culinary words like pasta, al dente, and gusto. From French, we get quiche, of course, salon, and a number of military terms like lieutenant, bayonet, artillery, coup d'etat, rendezvous, and esprit de corps. Not surprisingly, Spanish has given us many words we associate with the American Southwest, including coyote, Desperado, Tortilla, Lariat, and Mustang. Now we need to thank German for kindergarten and sauerkraut, and we should definitely thank Yiddish for bagels, schleps, schmucks, and mavens, experts in their field. And Gaelic gave us banshee, slogan, and, being Irish on both sides, I'm absolutely not surprised at this next one, whiskey. Whiskey was literally translated as water of life, a definition that many of my relatives would nod their heads in solemn agreement with. Now, the Gaelic word for whiskey was probably itself a loan translation from medieval Latin, aqua vitae. Bonsai, karaoke, and tycoon come from Japanese, and Sanskrit gave us karma, nirvana, yoga, not surprisingly, but also shampoo. And my teenage son would like to personally thank Arabic for giving us algebra. This relatively short list gives you a sense for how English acts like a sponge, soaking up words from just about everywhere, giving our language an incredibly rich vocabulary and allowing us to make finer shades of distinction among related concepts. So with this lexical richness in mind, let's get started with three target loanwords from German. For our first target word, picture this. You're a college student. Last semester, you took an advanced statistics class from a tough professor. As you struggled through the semester and barely pulled a C, your roommate was riding you the whole time, chiding you for your inability to grasp the material, and joking that it was going to pull down your almost perfect GPA. However, this semester, your roommate enrolled in the same stats class and happened to get the very same professor that you'd had. And now, he enters your room with a dejected look, sighs, and slumps into a chair. He says, "Well, I got a D on the first test. Go ahead and let me have it. I deserve it." Now, you aren't going to stoop to his level and say anything insulting. But you have to admit it. Deep down inside, there is a little part of you that's secretly glad that he's struggling. He finally got his comeuppance. That pleasant feeling you're experiencing at your roommate's expense is Schadenfreude, our first target word. Schadenfreude is a noun referring to satisfaction, pleasure, or malicious joy at someone else's misfortune. Let's put Schadenfreude in context. Unless you're a living saint, you've experienced Schadenfreude at one time in your life. Schadenfreude, a German word, came to English in the 19th century. In German, Schaden means damage, harm, or injury. And Freude means joy. So, Schadenfreude literally means damage joy in German. Think back to a time when you've experienced Schadenfreude. Make a connection in your vocabulary notebook. Sports and politics are two arenas where feeling joy at the opposing team's loss or the opposing party's loss is quite common. I get this feeling watching soccer sometimes. Now, my son and I are huge fans of the great soccer team FC Barcelona. And if you're a fan of Barcelona, then you don't have a choice. Your arch rival is Real Madrid. Now, last season, Barcelona didn't win the league. While I was disappointed, I have to admit, I was pleased as punch when we found out that Real Madrid didn't win the league either. That's Schadenfreude. Now, of course, English-speaking people have always had this feeling, but we didn't have the right word for it. Although there were some very rare English words that were close synonyms for Schadenfreude, for some reason they never caught on. Now, I knew that Schadenfreude had made it into mainstream American culture when it appeared on an episode of The Simpsons. Homer, the father, expresses joy at a rival's business failing, and his daughter Lisa uses the word and defines it for him. For our next target word, we're going to do a word association activity. I'm going to say a phrase, and when I do, I want you to think of all the words and images that come to your mind. Ready? The 1920s. What do you think of when I say the 1920s? Words, ideas, and images that probably come to your mind include the Jazz Age, the Roaring Twenties, flappers with bobs and knee-length skirts doing the Lindy Hop, Duke Ellington, speakeasies, Prohibition, F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby, Art Deco, and Babe Ruth. Now, as you know, the 1920s was a decade of sustained economic growth in the U.S. that saw the widespread use of telephones, automobiles, and motion pictures. People began to break from tradition and embrace modern life and technology. There was a feeling across the nation that modern ideas and technology could solve most anything. Now, we've just done a very brief but decent job describing a little bit of the zeitgeist of the 1920s. Zeitgeist is a wonderful noun we borrowed from German in the 1800s. It refers to the spirit, attitude, or general outlook of a specific period, especially as it's reflected in literature, philosophy, and culture. It's the general moral, cultural, and intellectual climate of an era. Now, in German, Zeit means time, and Geist means ghost or spirit. So, Zeitgeist means time spirit, or the spirit of the times. Write this down in your vocabulary notebook to help you remember this word. Let's put Zeitgeist in context. Are we all shaped by the Zeitgeist we grew up in? Or are there a few among us, the geniuses and the forward thinkers, who can rise above their time in history and see our world in an entirely new way? So to remember Zeitgeist, pick a time period or decade that stands out to you. Is it the 1960s? The 1990s? Make a list of the cultural touchstones, the moments and events that define that generation that stand out for you. What do you think was the general attitude or outlook of the public at the time? Jot your thoughts down as an example of Zeitgeist. For our next target word, I want to ask you a question. Have you ever watched the news or read a newspaper and come away with a great feeling of sadness or melancholy at the terrible events that occur in the world? If so, you've experienced Weltschmerz, our next target word that refers to a very specific type of sadness. Weltschmerz is a noun referring to sadness over the evils of the world. That's a feeling we've all had. It comes from the German Welt, meaning world, and Schmerz, meaning pain. When you experience Weltschmerz, you experience world pain or world weariness, pain at the evils and injustices in the world. It can also denote the depression caused by feeling the world's woes too sharply. To remember Weltschmerz, connect it to world pain. Also, think of a worldwide tragedy you've heard about, read about, or even experienced. In your vocabulary notebook, make a note of how this tragedy made you feel. Okay, we're moving from German to French. What do you think our next target word, éminence grise, means? Do you think éminence grise refers to an elder statesman or eminent senior member of a group, or a powerful decision maker who operates behind the scenes? You'll find out the definition as I tell you the incredible history of this word, based on the account of the Capuchin priest, Father Joseph, as told in the Merriam-Webster New Book of Histories. Now, born in 1577, Father Joseph joined the Capuchin order in 1599. In 1611, he met Cardinal Richelieu, who was appointed his secretary. Remember Cardinal Richelieu as Louis XIII's politically ambitious chief minister. These two made quite a powerful pair. Father Joseph became far more than just Richelieu's secretary, also serving as his confidant, his personal confessor, and even his secret agent. Many believe that Father Joseph wielded much more influence behind the scenes than was publicly acknowledged. Now, as you might imagine, this pair's rivals at court referred to them disparagingly behind their backs. Richelieu was referred to as l'éminence rouge, the red eminence, because of his scarlet cardinal's robes. And Father Joseph, who sported the habit of the Capuchins, was referred to as l'éminence grise, the gray eminence. However, the term éminence grise did not appear in general use in English until the 1920s. From the 1600s in France to the 1920s in English. Quite a wait for this word, huh? In fact, Aldous Huxley's 1941 study of Father Joseph, entitled Gray Eminence, helped establish both the original French term, Eminence Grise, and its English counterpart, Gray Eminence, in English. So, we come to our meaning of Eminence Grise, a noun referring to a powerful decision-maker or advisor who operates behind the scenes, or in a non-public or unofficial capacity. So if you said that Eminence Grise meant behind the scenes, you were right. Right? Not so fast. This word story doesn't stop here. In the second half of the 20th century, authors who weren't aware of this original meaning of Eminence Grise started using it in a positive sense to, get this, refer to an elder statesman or eminent senior member of a group. How could this positive meaning have come about? As the Merriam-Webster account relates, and I quote, "Doubtless the writers have mistakenly assumed that Eminence Grise derived from the notion that eminent senior figures are typically gray-haired. Doubtless, too, the sinister Capuchin friar would have appreciated the irony that his derisive epithet had assumed a meaning so approving." So, be prepared to encounter Eminence Grise used in both senses, a behind-the-scenes operator or a respected elder statesman. So to remember this word, we can go back in history to two behind-the-scenes power brokers in American politics. Harry Hopkins, one of FDR's closest and most powerful advisors, has been termed an Eminence Grise. So has Dick Cheney, President George W. Bush's vice president. Or think of someone you know who holds more power than their position or title might indicate. If so, you know an Eminence Grise. Let's review our first four loanwords: Schadenfreude, Zeitgeist, Weltschmerz, and Eminence Grise using the definition clue activity. Okay, number one. This is a word from German that literally means world pain. You might feel this after reading about a natural disaster or a human tragedy. Is it Schadenfreude or Weltschmerz? Answer: Weltschmerz is sadness over the evils of the world. World weariness. Number two, if I said the decade of the 1980s, you might think of the movie Wall Street, the ruthless stockbroker Gordon Gekko, and his famous line, "Greed is good," to sum up this decade's focus on financial gain. What target word meaning spirit of the times refers to the general attitude and outlook of an era or generation? Answer: Zeitgeist. Number three, the vice president of the company you work for really makes all the major decisions, even though the president is the public face of the company. When the vice president is fired for corruption, you're secretly happy. You never trusted the guy. What word refers to the vice president as a behind-the-scenes decision maker? Answer: Eminence Grise. And what word refers to your feeling of joy at the vice president's ouster? Answer: Schadenfreude. Okay, let's move on to the second half of today's lecture. For our next target word, mugwump, we're crossing the Atlantic from Germany and France and returning to America. Mugwump's an Americanism with a wonderful political history and a favorite word of mine. Mugwump originally comes from a word in the Native American Algonquian dialect that meant important person. However, by the 1830s, English speakers were using mugwump to mean great man, boss, important person, in a jesting, chiding sense to poke fun at people who thought particularly highly of themselves as big cheeses and head honchos. But then, during the United States presidential election of 1884, the meaning of mugwump shifted. James G. Blaine, the Republican candidate, was running against Grover Cleveland, the Democratic candidate. A faction of Republican political activists, who were highly critical of the financial corruption associated with Blaine, bolted the Republican Party to support the Democratic candidate, Grover Cleveland. The Republicans who remained loyal to Blaine were not happy and dubbed these Republican turncoats mugwumps, deriding their holier-than-thou, pompous attitudes and the supercilious way they tried to hold themselves above party politics. So this brings us to our current definition of mugwump. Today, mugwump is a noun referring to a person, especially a politician, who is unable to make up his mind on an issue, or a person who remains